the Podluck, serving up bite-sized taste of the best theology. I'm your host, Megan Westrup. Grab a plate and let's dig in. All right, and we are back. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Podluck today. Today is our last installment of this, asking the question of what does it look like to live as resurrection people in light of Easter, and kind of looking at different implications for our shared lives together. How do we not just bear witness to the resurrection in that we know Jesus is alive and we feel happy about that in our hearts and we're so glad that Jesus is alive, but like what implications does that have on our shared life together? And I think these questions are extremely important to consider, especially right now, during this time of pandemic and social distancing. And as we are all so keenly aware right now that our lives are interconnected, that we are more dependent on one another and on the choices of each person, and each person individually and collectively, more so than many of us would like to think about in kind of normal day-to-day life. And so I was really happy to share last week interviews with Dylan Neighbor-Cruz and with Caitlin Schess. And then I had hoped to get this one with the Reverend Dr. Eric Acheson up last week on Friday. But you know what they say about schedules in the time of Corona. It's all made up and time doesn't matter. So you're getting this on Tuesday, which is cool. And I certainly hope that you enjoy it now. So the Reverend Dr. Eric Acheson is an ordained pastor with the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ. He's the author of Oregon Trail Theology, The Frontier Millennial Christians Face, and How We're Ready. And I just have got to say, I love the Oregon Trail, and I played lots and lots and lots of hours of that growing up, and so that the title of his first book just makes me real happy. And then most recently, actually came out last week, so available now, is his second book, On Earth as It Is in Heaven, A Faith-Based Toolkit for Economic Justice. Woo, that's a subtitle. Faith-Based Toolkit for Economic Justice. Woo! So we're going to mostly be talking about that second book, although I think at the end of this interview, we do talk a little bit on the Oregon Trail, and he told me that you can actually play Oregon Trail on the internet now. And so if you would like to take a break from, you know, regularly scheduled life where we're all trying to avoid getting coronavirus and instead play a game where you try not to die of cholera, then more power to you. I know I certainly have enjoyed knowing that I can play that online now. So Eric currently serves at a church in Vancouver, Washington, where he lives with his wife and daughter and their two dogs, Sir Henry Wiggly and Dame Frida Koala, which those are wonderful dog names, which is why I had to share them with you. So I really enjoyed this conversation with Eric and with talking about what does it look like to approach economic justice through a faith-based lens. I know right now, so many of us are, concerned about coronavirus, but also in the couple of weeks since Eric and I recorded this interview, there's also been a lot of conversation around the economic aspect of all of this. And yeah, we don't want to get coronavirus and we don't want to get our neighbors sick, but what does it also look like to think in terms of economic flourishing and things like that? And those are really difficult questions to ask and ones that I am certainly not always well equipped to answer. But I think as we try to consider ways to think about the economy right now, that it's also an opportunity not to just say, how do we go back to normal? How do we, you know, open things back up? How do we get back to where we were? Because the reality is there were a lot of things about the way things were and the way things are that aren't working, at least not for a number of people. And so as we ask questions in this era about economics and about how we, you know, open things back up for business or whatever, that we ask questions also about what does economic justice look like? And for those of us who are coming from a faith-based or from a religious perspective, to have that be informed and in conversation with our faith. So I'm super excited to be sharing this interview with you. Like I said, now Eric's book is available. That has come out since we recorded this episode. And so go ahead and check the show notes, and I'm putting a link to where you can order the book and pick a copy of that up to help you and your own imagination as we reconsider what economic justice looks like in the age of corona. All right, grab a plate. Let's dig in.
Thanks for having me, Megan. I'm a Disciples of Christ pastor here in the Pacific Northwest, and have spent sort of the last 5 years or so really digging into sort of the economy of Southwest Washington State, where I've ministered now for almost 9 years. In part because it really is sort of an uncommon mixture, where you have the spillover of the Portland suburbs here in Vancouver, but as soon as you drive a few miles north, you have a lot of the industries that have been there for decades, pulp and paper milling, logging, and river trade, because the Columbia River is such a sort of massive entry point for international trade. And 5 years ago, a pretty uncommon thing happened in the town of Longview, where I was a pastor for almost 7 years, where the employees of two of the largest employers in town went on strike at almost the exact same time. The teachers of the Kelso School District went on strike as part of the statewide wave of strikes against an unconstitutional state budget for education. And at about the same time, the mill workers of the largest pulp and paper plant in the entire town also went on strike after 18 months of working without a collective bargaining agreement and having really sort of no end in sight in their negotiations with the mill management and ownership. And what I found was incredibly sort of both interesting and I guess a little discouraging, in that I did not see much or witness much of a religious presence, public presence with the striking workers. There was an outpouring, huge outpouring of community support for both the teachers and the mill workers. But I wasn't personally, at least, witnessing much religious support. And some of the religious support that I personally offered got some pretty severe backlash, the sort of like anonymous hate mail level of backlash. And I thought to myself, why is this happening? Like, how is it in a town with a very strong organized labor presence and a long sort of history of honoring labor, how has that not connected with the strong religious presence of the town, with dozens and dozens of churches in a decent size, not a huge town, about a combined 45 to 48,000, a lot of churches for a town that size. Mm-hmm. How is it that there is this disconnect between the two? And that ultimately became the entire topic of my doctoral thesis at Seattle University, was to ask both the pastors in town, so my own colleagues, but also their congregants who were members of one of the unions, if they attended church and were also a member of either the Kelso Education Association or the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, what were your memories of the strikes? And do you think the church should have had a role in it, or a bigger role? Through those responses kind of came to some levels of agreement of what is most important for the churches to do, to be in relationship with the workers in their community. even if those workers aren't members of an individual congregation, what is the role of churches? What is the role of clergy? What is helpful? And by the same token, what is maybe less helpful or not helpful? And so we tried to come to some level of agreement on what those actions were and how important it was to the workers that the church take these actions and these roles. And a lot of those roles really centered around the workers saying, this was an incredibly stressful period for me. There was so much uncertainty, and there needs to be a space for us to be able to talk honestly about it, to be honest about the stress that going on strike involves or that organizing involves, and to be honest about how it affects the community, and to not just pretend that it's not happening or feel like we can't talk about it in these communities in which we worship. And so the churches can really play this unique role of both forum and advocate, of being a space for other voices while also offering a voice to say, we want to be there for you, and we want to so to offer our voice in whatever way is most helpful to you. And so we want to listen to you and in turn offer our voice. And that's something that I really worked on honing in on as I took this sort of mountain of doctoral research and sort of turned it into a book that hopefully doesn't read like a thesis. Is, for instance, one of my friends from all the way back in college, he's been working for years now as an organizer for the SEIU, Service Employees International Union. And he said one of the most important things that churches can do is to sort of offer sort of their moral capital to local leaders and to management in a way that the workers themselves maybe can't. And to say, to come to the table from sort of this perspective, or maybe it's not quite, we're not quite trying necessarily to induce guilt, but maybe we kind of are just a little bit in saying, you know, do the right thing by your people. That we do still, as much damage as the church's reputation has maybe taken, and especially in a place like the Pacific Northwest, which is relatively agnostic or non-practicing or atheist to begin with, that the church does still have a little bit of that moral cachet left, and how we choose to use it really does matter. So from all of this, what I saw was there is this need, there is this desire for the church to inhabit a role that maybe we are not quite yet entirely comfortable inhabiting. In some circumstances, we might be. And here I'm thinking specifically of the history, for instance, of the Black church as a locus for civil rights. But in the white church, probably not so much. And to then say, okay, how can I offer a blueprint for churches to begin having these conversations with each other and with themselves? To say, can we engage with economic justice in a way that remains true to ourselves, but also true to our neighbors and to our communities? Because one of the biggest obstacles that I've seen in parish ministry, not just in Longview, but where I am now in Vancouver, is that increasingly, at least in the mainline, congregations do not resemble the communities they are physically, geographically located in. Increasingly, churches are a commuting destination where people have to drive across town or some distance to get to the churches that they belong to. And the churches, whether on the basis of age or socioeconomic status or race or ethnicity, no longer quite resemble the neighborhoods in which they are physically located. And I think that's part of the disconnect that I saw in sort of an absence of spiritual or religious presence alongside the striking workers in Longview, is that demographically, a lot of the churches are older and maybe aren't working, so they aren't part of the unions, or socioeconomically they're separated from the unions, or so on and so forth, that there is this separation that I'm not saying sort of created an us and them dichotomy. And that is a gap that urgently, I think, needs to be bridged. If the church is not only going to remain relevant in 21st century America, but can sort of live out this this biblical imperative news. Part of the good news is, Jesus is pretty unequivocal, is economic justice. And so once I arrived at that conclusion, the question is, well, how do I do that? And how do I do that in a 160-page book that, you know, people is easily digestible, that, you know, that isn't a gigantic treatise? And so I tried to approach this question from sort of three distinct points. One is, you know, since I'm a good old Protestant, is okay, what do the scriptures say, both the Tanakh and the Christian Testament? The second area that I wanted to focus on was, what has our history taught us? And I dedicate a chapter of On Earth as It Is in Heaven to sort of the history of the Western Church writ large, and then in the next chapter really hone in on the church in the United States, which isn't to say that economic justice wasn't an issue outside of the Western Church. It's just that I am not the person, I'm not an expert. And so for me to try to write about it would have done nobody justice. And then contemporary experience. You know, how is this playing out today? And I sort of try to divide that up in what I see as the movement of wealth away from particular communities. So age communities, generations, and then racial, ethnic communities of nationality. The movement of wealth away from those, and each of those gets their own chapter. And so now that I kind of have the structure, well, I'm calling this a toolkit, a faith-based toolkit for economic justice. Okay, what are the tools that I can offer? One tool I think is incredibly important is a survey of scripture that maybe is not, of scriptures that are maybe not familiar to us. And just to give an example, I think the first scripture passage that I cite in the chapter on the Tanakh is from Joseph as the vizier, as the viceroy of Egypt. And most of us have either watched Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat or at least familiar enough with its presence. What we miss from sort of the popular telling of the Joseph story is that the way Egypt survived was by Joseph enslaving it. It was by the people coming to Joseph and saying, we are starving. The stores that we have saved are no longer enough. Enslave us and feed us. Mm-hmm. And Joseph says, great. Mm-hmm. That is not really part of the story that we tend to teach in our children's Bibles, in our Sunday school classrooms, in our Bible studies. And I'm ashamed to say that I was already a made pastor before I really heard an in-depth treatment of that text as part of this sort of Lenten community discussion series in Longview several years ago. I had already been ordained at that point and had yet to really hear someone else really dig into that part of the story. So going through the Bible, what are maybe some of those stories, like that part of the Joseph story, that we haven't really spent a lot of time with for any number of reasons in the church? You know, I think we all, whether we admit it or not, have a canon within the canon, so to speak. And so I spend these first couple chapters trying to get us to broaden our canon. So that's the first tool I offer, is a broader canon within the canon. Is a familiarity with texts that we might not really know are in there, or maybe that we're uncomfortable with. Like, a lot of the good news for the poor in the Bible might make the rest of us uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to broaden that base. So that's the first tool that I really try to offer. And the next is an understanding of where our theology of the economy comes from. Like, and by theology, I mean sort of our devotedness to it, our fundamental belief in it, so much so that I actually sort of call it the divine economy, that in some ways we've maybe attributed godhood to our economy. And I try to illustrate where maybe economic ideas have really woven themselves into the fabric of in some cases, our very basic theology. And as an example, one example I use of that is the entire notion that Jesus died as a substitute for our sins, or substitutionary atonement theory. And contrary to popular belief, and I realize I may be preaching to the choir, that was not taught for the first 1,000 years of Christian history. It was not until St. Anselm of Canterbury went and wrote Cur Deus Homo, when God became man, and he based this idea of Christ as a substitute or payment for our sins on feudalism, which was the economic system he lived in, that in feudalism, as a peasant, if you wronged your lord, satisfaction was required. And so it took this redemptive relational connection between us and God as mediated through Jesus Christ and as taught by the church for the first 1,000 years and made it a legal relationship, or a relationship sort of based on accounting principles rather than on unconditional love. And so you have this belief in the crucifixion that isn't really based so much in what to that point was traditional church theology, and was based entirely in what was then contemporary economics. And so how does economics, or how has economics influenced church thinking in the Western world? And there are a number of ways, it's not meant to be exhaustive. I try to sort of pull out illustrations to show kind of the progression from feudalism to mercantilism to the age of discovery to sort of the capitalism of historical and contemporary America. And again, I'm not trying to build an exhaustive case here, but I'm trying to give people sort of a springboard where they now have the tools to go and learn more.
Yeah.
So that's the second tool, is to offer a historical context for beliefs that we may take for granted. Mm. And then finally, the third tool is a wider understanding of how these things that we take for granted are playing out in the world around us, and the tangible consequences that are a result. And I try to pick out a number of signifiers of poverty, such as living in a food desert. So roughly 1 in 4 Americans live in what is defined as a food desert, which means that you are living far enough away from a supermarket or grocery store that it's not a practicable source of nutrition. Medical bankruptcies. And I think that's something that especially whenever the dust settles from this global pandemic, is going to be something we have to talk about.
Yeah.
It was not too. I at least have not heard in the framing of the $2 billion economic relief, or $2 trillion, excuse me, economic relief package for the coronavirus. I haven't heard anything in there about provision for medical bankruptcies, even though for some people who have begun to recover from the coronavirus, their bills are coming due and they're in the tens of thousands of dollars, because that's what happens when you need intensive care in a hospital.
Yeah.
And medical bankruptcies are still, if not a majority, certainly a plurality cause of personal bankruptcies in the United States. Mm-hmm. So that's another. And then how sort of wealth extraction has taken place from generation to generation. Because the means do vary. So for instance, wealth extraction from our generation, student debt is the obvious one. Yep. But while the wealth extraction from our generation from student debt has been taking place, the wealth extraction from our elders, from the people who have been retiring, has also taken place, not just through the Great Recession and the deleterious effect it had on people's retirement accounts, but also as a sort of a double whammy, the lack of upward mobility of wages. So you've lost your retirement. You can't retire. You have to return to work, and your wages are effectively frozen. And that's a conundrum that has affected many, many, many of our elders. So while the economic challenges may look a little different from generation to generation, there is this common theme of, well, unless you really are in the 1%, whether by hook or by crook, we really are in the same boat together. Mm-hmm. Whether it's through student loan debt or medical debt or a retirement account, sort of, we are in this same boat together. Now, the asterisk I would leave there is what I devote the last chapter to, which is wealth extraction on the basis of race and ethnicity, which really layers on sort of everything that I just said, but also add to it land theft and the inhibition of wealth generation after centuries of chattel slavery. And that was by far the most difficult chapter for me to write, because I inhabit the sort of middle ground of simultaneously owing reparations and, as a descendant of genocide survivors, being owed reparations. Mm. So my mom's side of the family, they lost literally everything material in order to flee the Armenian genocide of World War I. Everything. Mm. Like, my relatives would look around and say, well, where did it all go? And the thing is, it went into us, our lives. We are alive because my great-grandparents and their brothers and sisters gave all of it up. At the same time, while I am a descendant of genocide refugees, I much more often than not still benefit from white privilege. So I have this very odd conundrum of speaking as someone who has a claim to reparations. Now, I personally don't think I could personally accept reparations, but what I realized is I don't get to decide that for everyone else. Mm-hmm. And so how do we have an honest conversation in a majority white Christian setting about what our historical obligations really are? Mm. And maybe this shouldn't be the case, but because of this white status that I usually have, I can at least begin this emotional labor of asking these questions. Okay, we've learned all of this from all these other chapters in the book. How can we? It's sort of a question of how can we put them to work here, mm-hmm. And I try not to come up with that answer by myself because I don't think it's my answer to give. Mm-hmm. I try to pull from Black and Indigenous sources to let them kind of tell that part of the story. And instead, what I try to do is to say, here's how I can empathize with this, recognizing that it's not my experience, and realize, okay, because of my family's past, I see how this affects people and why there is this urgent need for a response from the white church, that too is part of preaching the good news. Yeah. Is listening to people who say there is this need, recognizing, empathizing with that need. And for me, that comes from understanding what my family survived. And then not making a moral equivalency to it, but saying, because of this understanding, I recognize that there's an additional step to take. Mm-hmm. So let's figure out what that step is together. Mm-hmm. And so while I kind of leave that chapter a little open-ended, it's kind of by design, because I don't think I get to say entirely what what that looks like. And instead, I try to offer some different models from different people of here's what they have done to try to create some sort of redistribution of material resources. And that is going to be, I think, a really tough conversation for a lot of people in the church to have. Yeah. And that's why it was so hard for me to write it. But I couldn't, I don't think I could have in good conscience left it out either. Mm-hmm. That's sort of where I left the book was we've learned all of these different things together. We've learned about how expanding our canon within the canon is so important for understanding what God has shared about economic justice. We've learned about some of the history of economics that we may take for granted. And we've learned how this affects people across generations, across racial and ethnic lines, across geographical lines. So what do we do next? Yeah. And so maybe it's a little akin to like me saying, okay, there's this fire. I haven't quite told you what size hose we need. I give you some ideas, mm-hmm. but because my context is not your context, like I don't think I get to say, well, what does racial economic justice look like in Wisconsin? Even though I know that there's a lot of work to do there, just as there is here.
Yeah.
But I don't think as someone who's only lived in Kansas and the West Coast my whole life, that I get to tell people in Wisconsin, this is what it must look like. Instead, I say, here are the tools we can develop so that you can figure out, you can discern what it looks like in your context, in your communities. And so a lot of what I try to do is to sort of offer things that are replicable, that are doable in your community. As classes, as Bible studies, as congregational surveys, stuff that you don't need a PhD to do.
That's so good. I think so much good could come of just expanding our canon within the canon and knowing that history, right? Like those very first two tools that you offer in your book, I think could just dramatically expand our conversations and our imaginations as church congregations across the country. I know I also was in pastoral ministry by the time I heard that reading of Joseph's story. And I remember just being like, holy, what? Like the Prince of Egypt. What was the other one? The Joseph
King of Dreams.
Yes, that one. Yes. Like, they lied to me. They totally lied to me.
Yeah. Instead they just had this little ditty that kind of, this little montage that just skipped right over that.
You think Joseph is the hero. And then you're like, well, dadgummit, that guy. I think, so much of that, or even just trying to think through that our economic systems are not neutral and that they play off of our theology and they inform our theology. And those are so deeply intertwined, which is why there is so much in the scriptures about your economics. Because I think for me growing up, and I grew up in a very conservative religious community. Well, obviously capitalism is good.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously. Yeah. Like why would you even ask the question? Obviously it's good. Yeah. And so I think, I'm really glad that you go all the way to thinking about reparations in the book, because I personally don't think we can call it justice unless we've made reparation. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's just me.
I don't think it's just you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Just me.
No, I've heard that from others. So that's one of the part of that history of like, what do we take for granted? That's one of the things. Capitalism must be good.
Right.
Well, where does that come from? Mm-hmm. It comes from centuries long tradition of tycoons literally bankrolling circuit riding preachers.
Yep.
Of like funding the ministries of some very famous evangelists to go from town to town and basically preach anti-labor, anti-union, pro unfettered capitalism messages. And to sort of box down this message of economic justice in the Bible into one of not of justice, but of personal morality.
Right.
You know, I call it the church of be nice and chew with your mouth closed.
That's good.
Yeah. And that is one of those unquestioned beliefs that we have.
Right.
The belief came from somewhere. Mm-hmm. Like it didn't just form out of the ether. Mm-hmm. Like we came up with that belief. And I don't say exactly how to undo it or how long it'll take to undo. But I would hope that after what is going to look like a second great recession in 12 years, we can say that this experiment has failed.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, maybe we can say we tried to kind of get it to continue after after sort of that war on poverty that produced Medicaid and Medicare and Pell grants, but we can't say this experiment has been a success now. Like we just can't. So again, like where do we go from here? And maybe it is into the unknown, into something that maybe we haven't taken for granted. That's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I am very excited for people to read your book. I think that it's going to be super timely as we get to evaluate what life looks like on the other side and really seeing the deep cracks in so many of our systems right now. Where can people find your work? I will drop a link to your book in the show notes. It's available for pre-order. It comes out next month, right?
Yeah, April 17th, assuming that the apocalypse hasn't ended everything by then.
Sure, yeah.
For most authors, the best way is to buy directly from our publisher, which in my case is Church Publishing, the Press for the Episcopal Church. So you can go to churchpublishing.org, all one word, /on earth as it is in heaven. And you can also find it at a number of outlets, Powell's, Indie Book, Christian Book, obviously Amazon, although it's never my first choice for obvious reasons. And if it's tough, if it's tough for you to imagine buying a new book right now, like, believe me, I completely understand. But the other reason now, especially that I hesitate to recommend Amazon, is Amazon's going to survive this, and your smaller publishers and book distributors might not. So if I'm humbled if you choose to buy, and I would gently ask you to consider doing so sort of thoughtfully and responsibly.
That's good. And then where else can people connect with your work online?
My personal website is just my name, Eric, E-R-I-C, Atchison, A-T-C-H-E-S-O-N.com. I'm on Twitter at Rev Eric Atchison and Facebook also Rev Eric Atchison. Those tend to be the two places you can most easily find me. I think technically I have an Instagram account. I don't know if I've ever posted on it.
Technically.
So I would say Twitter and Facebook for sure. And you can also contact me directly through my website.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, I hope that people will consider picking up a copy of your book through the publisher and of your other book, Oregon Trail Theology, because we're all feeling a little bit like we didn't pack enough salt, pork, and laudanum right now.
that we're all worried about instead of dysentery and cholera, it's the coronavirus. Wash your hands. Stay home.
Yeah.
Stay home.
Stay home.
And make sure that our listen to our public health experts and our medical experts. Listen to them.
Yes. So stay home.
Yes,
buy
you can
some books. Read his books while you stay home.
Yeah, and you can find Oregon Trail Theology at all of the same outlets that I just named.
Cool.
If you're looking for something to do at home, you can still play the Oregon Trail computer game online.
Oh, can you really?
There are ROMs. Yeah, go to classic-reload.com and you can play the retro Oregon Trail game.
That just made my whole day.
Yeah.
Like, I know what I'm doing all day on Saturday. That sounds amazing.
It's still a blast. Like, it still has the pixelated magic all these years later. Yeah.
Oh, I'm really glad we did this interview just so now I have that information so I can go play some Oregon Trail this weekend.
You know what? It is. There are far worse ways to spend your social distancing hours.
Oh, heck yeah, there are. Oh, that's so great. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Eric.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
Yeah, have a good one. All right. And thanks so much again for tuning in to another episode of The Podluck. Like we said in the episode, Reverend Eric Acheson's book, On Earth as It Is in Heaven, A Faith-Based Toolkit for Economic Justice, is out now as of just a couple days ago, just last week. So go ahead and pick up a copy of that. These questions are going to be super important for us to think about in the days to come as we kind of make our way through this season of coronavirus and whatever is on the other side of that. Everything is super disrupted right now, which is really uncomfortable. And it is really unnerving in lots of ways that we are all being confronted with our own worries and our own fears and our own concerns, and also the ones in the broader world and our public life, shared life together. And so let's be really intentional about how we come out of this season. Yeah. Let's be really prayerful and mindful that we don't just seek to go back to normal, but that we seek to build something that's just and equitable on the other side, that we maybe look at some of the things that haven't been working and try to make them work. Thanks for tuning in, and please do pick up Eric's book. The link is in the show notes for the publisher, because I think that's such a good encouragement to be mindful, if it's possible, for those of us who have the option right now to do things like buy new books or things like that, we're also being mindful about where we're choosing to purchase things and trying to support small businesses or local businesses whenever we can. So I will put the link in the show notes to his publisher directly. But like you said, you can access that book in multiple places as well. So thanks again for tuning in. Make sure, if you are listening to this and you are not subscribed, go ahead and hit subscribe. And if you're enjoying these Corona Kegger episodes of The Podluck, then go ahead and leave a rating or a review, because that helps other people find us too. We'll be continuing later this week. I'll be back in your ears on Thursday. We're going to look back on some mental health things, kind of turn our attention back to some mental health conversations on Thursday, and then into next week as well. This coming Thursday, I'm going to be talking with Elizabeth Behrens. She's going to be talking, yes, about some like mental health, mental awareness things, but also kind of bringing back around the conversation of what do we do with kids during this time of pandemic. My own kid, who is right next to me while I'm recording this, just looked at me with big wide eyes that looked very excited. What do you think about that cadence? Does it sound good to have another conversation about kids and coronavirus?
Yay!
Yeah, super important. Because is it important to talk to kids about hard things?
Kind of.
Kind of? Yeah. What about things like coronavirus? Like, is it important for us to have conversations about that?
It is, because even kids can help stop it.
Yeah, even kids can help stop it. And have I been a little bit stressed out lately because of all this stuff?
Yes!
Yes, yes, I have. Have you been, like, sad or stressed or angry about any of this stuff?
It's been very hard to sleep because I miss my friends.
Totally, yeah. So it's important to be talking about these things. It was not planned for Cadence to be weighing in on this. She just happens.
Nope.
She just happens to be here with me right now, because that's life right now. We are just with each other all the time. Yep. So anyway, Elizabeth Behrens is going to be joining us on Thursday, talking about talking with kids about coronavirus, and then we will kind of use that as a jumping off point into another kind of trio of episodes with a similar theme. Talking about mental health, how we have good conversations about hard things and show up to our lives and our feelings about our lives right now. Should we talk about feelings?
Maybe.
Maybe.
And if you haven't heard my podcast episode, you should.
Yeah, yeah. And if you missed our first kids and coronavirus conversation, Cadence offers her own input on that. You don't always like talking about your feelings, huh?
Nope.
Nope. Nope, but you like talking about other people's feelings, right?
Yeah, that's with a lot of people.
Yep, that's a whole mood, isn't it?
Yeah!
Yep. All right, so hit the subscribe button. You don't want to miss any of that. Go back and listen to Cadence's episode. She would love that.
But I will be a little nervous.
And she'll be a little nervous. That's everybody. Yep, all right. And yes, so this has been The Podluck. Thanks so much for tuning in. Next time, grab a plate and dig in, as we serve up some more bite-sized taste of the best theology.